Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
This will be the show in which you can rent a really nice car for $2,000 a day. You can figure out how the internet ought to be regulated, if at all. And I know you're going to love this one. Revisit high school chemistry. Yes, indeed. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. Monday, today, the 12th of May. Great, as always, to have you with us. There are days, of which this happens to be one, in which the news hasn't quite happened yet. That is a not-so-subtle way of letting you know that we're going to start today with something that is probably going to break in a day or maybe two, Wednesday, Thursday at the latest. The Wall Street Journal and others are reporting that the FCC, the Federal Communications Commission, is set to finesse, revisit, shall we say, the commission's much-lamented prior ruling on something called net neutrality, making sure everybody has equal access to digital content. This is fundamentally a regulatory question, as in how should the internet be regulated, like a private for-profit enterprise or as a public utility? Marketplace's David Weinberg gets us going.
Kevin Werbach served as counsel for new technology policy at the FCC in the 90s. He says, on one hand, the internet has become essential infrastructure for life and business, much like other public utilities.
But in telecommunications regulation, calling something utility has a particular legal meaning.
The legal framework in this case revolves around Title II. That's the law that gives the FCC the authority to regulate the telecom industry.
If broadband access is under Title II, then it's subject to much broader authority of the FCC to prohibit what's called unjust and unreasonable discrimination.
Proponents of net neutrality say the FCC could use Title II to stop cable companies from creating fast lanes, like when Netflix agreed to pay Comcast extra for faster streaming. But
when the Supreme Court and the Federal Communications Commission have looked at whether the internet is properly regulated as a public utility, they've consistently said no.
Christopher Yu is a law professor who specializes in internet regulation. Under the FCC's new revised proposal, internet providers are still allowed to make deals and create fast lanes. But the new proposal suggests that the FCC will use its authority to make sure those deals are fair. Any efforts to regulate the deals, however, will likely be challenged in court.
So there are substantial legal obstacles to regulating the internet like a public utility.
In the end, it may not be the FCC, but the courts that decide how the internet should be regulated. I'm David Weinberg from Marketplace.
Today's mergers and acquisitions news is brought to us by the food industry. Hillshire Brands of Chicago, purveyor of Jimmy Dean sausages and Hillshire Farm lunch meats, will spend $4.25 billion for Pinnacle Foods of Parsippany, New Jersey. Duncan Hines cake mixes, Bird's Eye frozen veggies, Vlasic pickles, etc., etc. Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman reports that this is, of course, a deal about increasing corporate clout at the grocery store, but also about the changeable and fickle preferences of the American consumer.
Take this.
We've always taken a lot of pride in the fact that we make the finest sausage.
And this.
A zesty bite of a Vlasic pickle can liven up any occasion.
Yeah!
And you get sausages and pickles for breakfast? Also, you get a merged food manufacturing powerhouse that can offer frozen peas and ballpark franks, pancake syrup, and TV dinners.
It's really one big junk food company buying another big junk food company.
That's food industry critic Michael Jacobson at the Center for Science in the Public Interest, though he adds Hillshire will be getting Pinnacle's frozen food brand.
Bird's Eye does make some very healthful frozen vegetables.
And that's where Hillshire, the prepared meat company, needs to be making its pitch to consumers these days, says Hester John at Ibis World.
The grocery aisles are just getting flooded with all natural, whole grain. And so these household brand names are definitely facing intense competition.
Health-conscious consumers these days are shopping more around the outskirts of the grocery store for the veggies and fresh prepared salads and stuff. So companies like Hillshire will try to lure people back into the center aisles. That's where the packaged, processed, and profitable items are, says consultant Paul Weitzel.
You know, I think convenience is one trend that everyone continues to chase, resealable portion control.
And Weitzel says, following the merger, Hillshire will have more clout with grocery chains to do promotions and hog more shelf space. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
Wall Street this Monday, another day, another record. It's going to be the happy music when we get there. Every year about this time, the big television networks treat us, the viewing public, to a sneak preview of their fall lineups. New shows, old shows with new stars, shows that won't be with us anymore. Except the whole thing is not really for us. ABC, CBS, Fox, and NBC rent out glitzy venues. They get their big-name talent on stage, and they try to convince advertisers to part with their money in an annual ritual known as the upfronts. Marketplace's Noel King has the story.
The NBC upfronts were this morning, and the forthcoming show State of Affairs got a lot of buzz. Movie star Katherine Heigl plays a top CIA analyst.
Total slob in my personal life, total sniper in my professional one.
So, a well-known actress and a well-established genre, the national security spy thriller. Brad Adgate, the senior vice president of research at Horizon Media, was at the NBC upfronts and says the network brought out the big guns.
Seth Meyers came out, he did a very funny monologue. Jimmy Fallon came out and did a skit.
Once the upfronts have finished later this week, negotiations will begin. Adgate says TV networks are competing for more than $20 billion in ad revenue.
The advertisers meet with the sales representatives of the networks and they negotiate how many commercials they're going to buy. You know, what's the cost going to be?
The spectacle of the upfronts hasn't changed much over the years, but Janine Poggi, who reports on TV for Advertising Age, says advertisers used to start negotiating with networks around Memorial Day and wrap up by the 4th of July. These days, the haggling is dragging on much longer.
It's really because of the TV marketplace in general. We talk about the other digital opportunities that are out there and the ability to shift some money out of TV and into digital.
Digital that has grown so powerful, it now has its own version of the upfronts called the New Fronts, which, featuring Hulu, BuzzFeed, and Maker Studios, among others, took place last month. I'm Noel King for Marketplace.
The brand is, as we all know, everything in this economy. Nothing less than the repository of all the good or ill will the product-consuming public has toward Company A or Company X. So, naturally, one's brand name is often protected by millions of dollars and armies of lawyers. But as Clausewitz so famously once said, no campaign plan survives first contact with the enemy. And the enemy in this case is us. We have, throughout history, taken those brand names and made them nothing more than just regular words. Marketplace's Sabri Benishour has more now on the tug of war between language and branding.
So it turns out the English language is a graveyard for brand names. We have a lot of words that were once trademarked brands.
Aspirin, cellophane, escalator.
Roger Schechter is a professor of law at George Washington University. He has a really good list.
Yo-yo, trampoline, and then there's my personal favorite, heroin.
Yeah, heroin was a trademark, like Nike or Aunt Jemima.
There used to be a branded form of morphine called heroin.
Now, companies put a lot of money into protecting their trademarks, obviously. So for a company to lose their trademark, it's
a disaster.
And trademark lawyers actually have a word for this, for when you lose your trademark because your brand becomes the generic buzzword for a product.
Genericide.
Now, of course, companies these days try to prevent that.
A classic example is Xerox.
Jed Wakefield is a partner at Fenwick & West, and he advises firms who are anxious about losing their trademark rights.
Xerox years ago used to advertise to remind the public that Xerox is a brand name for a photocopier, and it's not a generic term for making a photocopy.
What Xerox did there was give the public another word to use instead of Xerox. They offered the word photocopy. That's because companies at most risk of genericide are the ones that invent something totally new, where there's not an existing word for it.
Frisbee. What else do you call it?
Ron Butters is professor emeritus of English at Duke. He says the actual moment when a trademark dies happens in court, when a judge decides a name has become generic. But these days,
it doesn't happen very often anymore.
Because companies don't let it. Although ideally, they could have the best of both worlds.
Like FedEx. Someone might say, I'll FedEx that to you. One could certainly argue that that's promotional for the FedEx brand.
As long as people still know it's really a brand. If a firm ever lets its guard down, we, the genericidal public, might steal that brand away and FedEx it straight into the dictionary. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishour for Marketplace.
We chat from time to time with Justin Rowlett from the BBC about a series he's doing on the things that, honestly, most of us haven't thought about since high school chemistry, if then at all. Specifically here, the chemical elements and the role they play in the global economy. It's called elementary business. And today's lucky winner has the atomic number 17, symbol Cl on the periodic table, chlorine, as we all know, of course. Hello, Justin.
Hi, Kai. How are you doing?
I'm well, but I confess just about the only thing I know about chlorine is that it makes my swimming pool safe and you can use it to bleach your clothes.
We will come on to swimming pools later, but right. Chlorine is absolutely fascinating. I mean, this is a deadly gas.
Yeah.
It's a really powerful toxin, and it's hiding, lurking, if you like, in that most innocuous of household chemicals, in salt. Because as we all know, salt is, of course, sodium chloride. And what you want to do is you want to rip them apart and release this gas, which is an incredibly useful gas in chemistry and, of course, in industry as well.
Expound upon that for a minute. Give me the uses thereof.
They are almost endless. I mean, there are something like 15,000 different chlorine-based chemicals that are used in industry. But PVC, for example.
Polyvinyl chloride, right?
Polyvinyl chloride. And if you look around your house, you know, all your drain pipes, for example, are made of PVC. Your window frames are probably made of PVC. Yep. Your floors are made of PVC. Your car seats are made of PVC. And that's just the beginning, because polyurethane, another, you know, famous plastic, if you can say such a thing, that's kind of sneakers, tennis shoes and stuff are made of, foams for insulation, all that kind of stuff. Again, chlorine essential to its manufacture. So here is this chemical of which is kind of in almost everything. 90% of pharmaceuticals, lots of agricultural products and chemicals use chlorine. So an incredibly useful thing. But that is just the beginning.
We were going to go back to the swimming pool, right?
Here's the thing, Kai. That chlorine smell we associate with swimming pools?
Yes.
I've got some bad news for you. That isn't actually chlorine.
What do you mean?
That is actually a compound called chloramine, which is created when chlorine combines with organic substances in the water. So you know when that chlorine smell smells a lot stronger?
Stop.
Are in the pool?
Stop.
You see where I'm going with this?
Yes, I do. Stop.
Chlorine,
stop.
Kai.
All right, fine. Justin Rowlett from the BBC. Thank you, Justin.
Cheers, Kai.
Sometimes it's better not to know, right? You can see what progress Justin is making through the periodic table and find links to the original series that he did at the BBC. Those links are on our website. It's marketplace.org. Coming up, what on earth do people do with a $340,000 Ferrari anyway?
They go to Starbucks 50 times. They drive around Times Square a million times. You rent the car to be seen.
You better believe it, baby. The exotic rental car market coming up. But first, let's do the numbers. All right, here you go. The Dow Industrial is up 112.7%. Another all-time high, 16,695. The NASDAQ up 71 points, 1.75%, 41.43. The S&P 500 also recorded a personal record, 18 points higher, nearly 1%, ended things at 1896. That $4 billion packaged food merger that Mitchell was talking about up top, investors thought it was a great idea for Pinnacle Foods. Pinnacle stock up 13% today. Hillshire, on the other hand, down 3%. Deal highlighted a lot of the changes happening in the packaged food business. Post Foods got a 3% bump today. Just last month, the Grape Nuts cereal company bought refrigerated potato and French toast maker Michael Foods for $2 billion. In tech, Twitter unveiled a new feature that lets users of its mobile products mute specific people in conversations. Investors turned up the volume 6% today. You're listening to Marketplace.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at what's coming up Tuesday. The 150th anniversary of Arlington National Cemetery is marked with a wreath-laying ceremony, the first in a series of commemorative events. Doing any shopping ahead of summer? Your purchases may be reflected in these numbers. The Commerce Department reports retail sales data for April. And 10 years ago, after 11 seasons, the series finale of Frasier aired. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Rizdal. The bar, generally speaking, for rental cars is pretty low. Is all my stuff going to fit? How much is it going to cost? The basics, yeah? The agent at the counter will always try to upsell you bigger model, GPS, collision insurance, gas. But that is upsell in the bush leagues, baby. You want to talk upgrades? Let's go with a Lamborghini, or better yet, Ferrari. From WHYY, Tracy Samuelson takes the idea of super high-end rental cars out for a spin.
If you're not familiar with the Ferrari 458 Spider, all you need to know is that it's crazy expensive. This one is bright red with a retractable roof. Gotham Dream Cars paid about $340,000 for it. Actually, more than it lists for because the car is so popular. But they'll rent it to you for the day for the bargain price of $2,000. Today, the car is on its way to a midtown hotel, to Andreas Arnoff, who's visiting from Norway.
We actually wanted the Murcielago.
That's a Lamborghini.
But it was out-rented from tomorrow, so we had to go with the Ferrari.
He's 24, says he works in real estate. Cars are a hobby. And he can afford it, he says, so why not?
What do you drive in Norway?
I have a Porsche 911 Turbo and a Cayenne Turbo, and just sold my R8 Spider.
So he's used to the kind of attention these supercars can attract.
Focus in the front of the car?
Yeah, the engine is in the back.
Wow, look at this. Thank you.
In the last few years, more companies have started renting luxury and exotic cars, including some big national chains like Enterprise and Hertz. At the Newark airport, Hertz has a Jaguar and a Mercedes parked on a ramp that Paula Riviera calls the eye candy display.
We weren't sure how customers were going to be receptive of the collection. So we started about a year and a half ago at 25 cars, a couple Lamborghinis, a few Ferraris, and it's proven so popular that today we have more than 1,000 cars.
She says some people who have booked a regular old midsize might walk by the display and upgrade on the fly.
You could go to Kansas City. You could go to Detroit and rent a dream car. You don't have to go to those luxury vacation destinations.
Chris Brown is the executive editor of Auto Rental News. He says the move into exotics makes sense because the car rental market is very competitive.
I wouldn't say it's saturated, but it's certainly full. So the majors, the major car rental companies are really looking for new avenues to exploit.
But on the other hand, he thinks exotics will stay a niche business for these companies.
And although luxury and exotic car rentals may be growing into other parts of the country, the lion's share of the market's going to stay in South Florida, in Southern California, maybe New York.
The car is an accessory, says Gotham COO Rob Ferretti. Data from the cars show that people don't even drive them that fast.
Most people rent the car to drive around. They do. They go to Starbucks 50 times. They drive around Times Square a million times. You rent the car to be seen.
So I asked Andreas Arnoff what he was planning to do with his Ferrari rental.
Shopping.
Shopping?
Yeah.
Okay. Where are you going?
See some Woodbury or something. So, outlet, I think.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Yep. He's driving to New Jersey to go outlet shopping in a Ferrari. In New York, I'm Tracy Samuelson for Marketplace.
Today is the last day of India's five-week-long national election. More than 800 million eligible voters all told. And results are expected, amazingly enough on that, by Friday. The capital city of the world's biggest democracy and one of its biggest economies is the subject of a new book by Rana Dasgupta. It's called Capital, The Eruption of Delhi. Rana, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
You are not originally from Delhi, are you?
No, I moved there when I was about 29 years old, which was 14 years ago.
So what was it about Delhi that brought out of you this book, which is and here are some words not often heard on this broadcast. It is lyrical. It is imagery-filled. It is it's dense, right? It's thick. It's a tough read. But it's really interesting. What was it about Delhi that made you write it?
The city that I lived in had turned during that time from a kind of administrative town into a hub of the global economy. It had produced billionaire fortunes. Hundreds of thousands of people had been moved out of the city from slums. And I thought it was a chapter in the kind of onward march of capitalism that needed to be written about and recorded.
You actually say that this is this book is about the rising middle class, that slice of the Indian economy that has benefited the most from globalization, yes?
Yes. I mean, they're the people who, in a way, I think, tell people in other parts of the world who are not in India witnessing these things what might happen to their world under the influence of these new emerging centers. And it felt to me that as India and other places like it rose to positions of influence within the global economy, I felt that everyone's world was going to change and these people were going to alter the system they were in.
What happens then to Delhi, though, as, you know, you get Starbucks on every street corner, you know, by the India Gate, and there are Amazons and Kentucky Fried Chickens and all of that stuff, and one day Delhi looks like Berlin or Manhattan?
Well, one of the things I think I'm trying to say is that that's only partly true, that we do have all those things now that you just listed. But I think that those things are not the same things in these new places as they were in the old. They mean different things to people. We also have an economic structure that's very different. We have still a lot of poor people. India is a poor country. And so these things arise in sort of islands, middle-class islands within a large country that's not like that for most people. And I think what the book is trying to say is that there's nothing about the Western past that instructs us about the Asian future. The Asian future is unwritten. And to some extent, the formation that we see in a place like Delhi of great inequality, I see this actually as a hyper-modern situation. These are the things that even European countries are very concerned about right now.
And not just Europeans, I will tell you, right? I mean, you know, that seems to be a universal theme.
Yes.
Yeah. You know, your line about the Western past and the Asian future hit me because one thing that comes out clearly in this book is how so much of what happens in India and Delhi today is still influenced by British imperialism and what happened 100-some-odd years ago.
Many countries like China and India, they have very different histories to the Western history. I mean, for two centuries or so, our global system has been run by first European countries and then by America. And we've had this sense, which was, of course, deliberate, that all countries that became modern would become Western. I think this is the idea that's breaking down now as we start to realize that there are very modern countries that are very successful in the global economy that have no intention of becoming Western at all.
This is, I probably should have said this earlier, this is a work of nonfiction, yet you are a novelist and a short story writer. What made you do it this way instead of a different way?
Well, my sense is that we are all of us, wherever we are in the world, we are entering an era that we don't really know, whose rules we don't really know. We don't really know, for instance, if we're going to live in a Chinese civilization in the coming century. What will it mean to be in America when America is no longer the first economy of the world? I mean, it has been since about 1900. So no one is alive who's ever lived in a world in which America is not the biggest economy in the world. But most of us will be alive when that ceases to be the case. And in writing this book, I felt that I shouldn't preempt the reality. I shouldn't try and make it up and write a novel about it. I should actually go and talk to people and find out what's going on, because I felt it was probably stranger than I could imagine. Hmm. And that if I were to speak to people around me who were imagining new things for themselves, at every scale of possibility, that I would discover much, much weirder and more wonderful things about how the future was unfolding than I could just make up on my own.
The latest book by Rana Dasgupta is called Capital, The Eruption of Delhi. Thanks very much for your time.
Thank you for having me.
This final note on the way out, a peek of sorts inside our wallets by the Federal Reserve Bank of San Francisco. They did a study on how we spend money, literally how, cash, credit, what have you, not on what do we spend it. So here's how it breaks down. By absolute number of transactions, cash is king, 40%. But once you take value of transactions into account, it's a whole different ballgame. The average value of a cash transaction, only $21. Checks, $168. Debit cards, $44. So now you know. All right, we got to go. That's Marketplace from 8 p.m. on this Monday. Today, the Dow up 112 points, all-time high, 16,695. The NASDAQ gained 72 points, about 1.75%, 41.44. The S&P 500 up 18 points, almost 1%. Our daily production team includes Bridget Bodner, Tommy Andres, Josh Wu, Millie Jefferson, and Melissa Yeager-Miller. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.